Good afternoon, everyone. This is work group two, looking at exceptions under information blocking. On the work group, we have Andy Truscott, Valerie Gray, Ariane Malik, Stephen Lane is absent, Anil Jain may be late, and Michael Adcock may not be able to join. So with that, why don't we go ahead and get started, and I'll turn it over to Andy to get us started.
Thank you very much, Lauren. Good afternoon, everybody. Thank you for taking your time on this wonderful Friday afternoon. I appreciate we're all looking forward to heading out for the weekend. In the meantime, us and then is a couple of hours to discuss the exceptions around information blocking. I'm going to turn the microphone now over to Mark Nee. So Mark works for ONC and is going to guide us through just a half-hour information session around the thinking from ONC that went into the current drafting of the exceptions in the draft rules that we are making comments and recommendations upon. So and this is just a follow-up from the main task force meeting that we had earlier today, where we covered off a large amount of the thinking behind the other aspects of the information blocking rule. And this is just to finish off that with the specific background information around the exceptions. I know he'll be supported by a cast from ONC as well as he goes through that. Mark, over to you, sir.
Yeah, thanks, Andy. And, you know, I don't want to take away too much time from this task or from this work group, because I know there's a lot that we need to get done. But, you know, I appreciate that you all would like to have some more information provided about the intent of, I guess, what we have to present today is just the exceptions for 204 and 206, which are recurring costs reasonably incurred and RAND licensing. You know, I'm happy to go through those. I do want to emphasize, of course, that, you know, it's really important to understand all of the exceptions. And we have some great fact sheets available on healthit.gov /HRM that has a lot of the same material that I'm going to be going over, generally speaking. So I guess you could do next slide. It's the slide that starts with overview of exceptions. And, you know, feel free to jump in if you have any questions as I go or clarifications. We tried to make these slides pretty clear without overloading. So some of this is just, you know, redundant for this group. I was expecting to be presenting for the larger task force, but as you all know, there are seven proposed exceptions, and each one has corresponding conditions that need to be met in order to get coverage under the exception. And those exceptions are proposed at 45 CFR 171.201 through 207. The bullet, second bullet here is important because it talks about if the actions of a regulated actor, so thinking of the scope of what we're talking about here, as we talked about earlier today, the actors that are regulated under CURES are the healthcare provider, health IT developer of certified health IT as we define it, health information network or exchange. They'd have to satisfy one or more exception, and if they did, the actions would not be treated as information blocking, and the actor would not be subject to the civil penalties the actor was a developer, network, or exchange, or other disincentives as appropriate, as CURES says, for providers. You know, just real briefly, where we were coming from with each of these groups of exceptions is, with the first three, 171, 201 through 203, which is preventing harm, promoting privacy and security, we kind of thought that without these exceptions, actors would be reluctant to engage in reasonable and necessary activities that prevent harm or promote privacy or security. And in our opinion, this would erode the trust in the health IT ecosystem and undermine efforts to provide access and facilitate the exchange and use of EHI in really important situations that they should be allowed to do so. The next three exceptions, two of which we'll focus on over the next few minutes, have more to do with promoting competition and consumer welfare. And they emphasize that information blocking is critical for promoting innovation and supporting competition. throughout these sections, there are some overarching themes. We talk about we view patients as having an overwhelming interest in their EHI, and particularly observational health. And as such, you know, thinking about it, I think I've said this before on this call or a different one, EHI should not be traded or sold to those actors who are, or by those actors who are custodians of the EHI or control the access, exchange, or use. And the last exception, just 207, recognize, it's kind of in its own category. It recognizes that it may be reasonable and necessary for actors to make health IT temporarily unavailable for the benefit of the overall performance of health IT. So what we did here with these seven exceptions, you know, big picture is that we took the definition of information blocking in CURES. They asked us to identify reasonable and necessary activities that would not constitute information blocking, and then we developed these categories of practices that could constitute information blocking, but if they were reasonable and necessary, you could avoid being covered by the information blocking definition. All right, next slide. Let's see where we're at. And does anyone have any questions or comments about that overview? Nope. All right. So for recovering costs reasonably incurred and RAND licensing, really, these came about because we heard from stakeholders throughout the process, like Mike laid out, that one of the main ways, you know, among others, that we heard that entities were information blocking was through certain fees and costs and licensing contracts, things like that. And so we wanted to address those bad actors and bad actions, but we also, you know, acknowledged that we want to promote innovation and competition, and that there are reasonable costs and licensing royalties and such that are appropriate. And without those, the ability to charge those costs and to make a reasonable profit, you know, folks in the market wouldn't have an incentive to push the envelope and promote innovation and create new products. So we tried to create this balance with these exceptions that, like I said, promote innovation and foster competition. As you can see on this slide, we say that under the proposed exception, it will not be information blocking for an actor to recover its reasonable costs of enabling access, exchange, or use of EHI. The proposed exception does not prescribe the amount of fees that can be charged, but imposes conditions to ensure that an actor's method for recovering costs is reasonable and non-discriminatory. So as you can see with the stacked diagram here, our approach really, we look at the method for recovering costs. We don't prescribe the specific amounts of fees or look at, you know, we consider different approaches, but we landed on this one because we felt that it provided the most flexibility, and especially for an ever-changing health IT market. As far as our objective, I mean, this is a bit redundant, but I'll repeat it again. We want to enable actors to recover the costs reasonably incurred to develop technologies and provide services that enhance interoperability while not protecting rent-seeking opportunistic fees and exclusionary practices that interfere with access, exchange, or use. An important point, as you can see at the bottom of the objective section, is that reasonable profits would be allowed under both recovering costs reasonably incurred and also RAND licensing exception. And I just want to note that for both of these exceptions, we worked very closely with the FTC to determine the right approach. And, you know, it was difficult because, as we've talked about in our group about RAND licensing, this is a new area of law, and there's not always going to be a clean fit for other processes or standards. So we tried our best to use existing approaches, but also make it work for our specific purposes. Next slide.
All right. Before you I apologize. Yeah. Before you go on.
Sure.
So you use the term reasonable profit. I think we've already noted that term isn't included in the reg text. But is there a is there a publicly available interpretation of reasonable that, or
well,
reasonableness test that that would be used or could be used in interpretation of that word?
You know, I think, Arian, this was brought up at the high tech meeting, and I think Elise addressed it. And what I'd say is, you know, I tell you to look at the preamble. I'm sure you have already. Look at what we've said. You know, you're right. We don't specifically say profits in the reg text, but we do explain our approach and our intent in preamble. And if that is not clear, then we definitely take comments on that. As far as what is reasonable, you know, that's the standard that we've used in a number of instances throughout this rule. And I think we provide examples in the preamble. I need to look specifically for what you're asking about, but I know we provide lots of examples of what could constitute reasonable. But as far as providing a definition, we don't have, you know, a set definition, you know, just as far as why. It's, you know, reasonableness is a standard that's used in law, and also the wide scope and type of cases that we're going to see. Sometimes it seemed like if you try to put a definition on reasonable, it wouldn't really make sense. But, you know, that's to say we welcome comments, and if you have an idea of what you reasonableness should mean in this context, we welcome those thoughts.
Okay. Thank you.
Yeah, sure. Okay. I'll try to get through these pretty quickly because, I know we have a lot to talk about. So the next slide is just the method by which an actor recovers costs. So this is kind of a checklist of what the OIG mostly would look at in conjunction with us to determine whether a cost was reasonably incurred. The cost would need to be based on objective and verifiable criteria that are uniformly applied for all substantially similar or similarly situated classes of persons and requests. So I think Arian actually had asked a question about this perhaps at some point during a previous meeting, and we do kind of lay out, maybe it was in the context of what objective and verifiable meant, but we do try to clarify that uniformly applied for all substantially similar or similarly situated classes. It's a real tongue twister there. Second, must be reasonably related to the actor's costs of providing the type of access, exchange, or use to or at the request of the person to whom the fee is charged. The fees must be reasonably allocated among all customers to whom the technology is supplied or for whom the technology is supported. And this one you see a lot, it has to do with competition. It must not be based in any part on whether the requester or other person is a competitor, potential competitor, or will be using the data in a way that facilitates competition with the actor. So throughout these provisions, we want to make sure that you can't treat someone in an unfair way because they were competition. So we made that clear. And then must not be based on the sales, profit, revenue, or other value that the requester or other persons may derive from access, exchange, or use. And this is important, that exceeds the actor's reasonable costs for providing access, exchange, or use of EHI. All right, next slide. Okay, was that? No, I think, oh, actually, there's one more. There should be one more. Oh, yeah, that one. Yep, exactly. So this one, so our approach was, at first we laid out the methodology that would need to be used to show that costs were reasonably incurred, but we also explicitly call out certain costs that are excluded and would not be recoverable. Those costs are listed here, costs that are incurred due to the health IT being designed or implemented in a non-standard way that unnecessarily increases the complexity, difficulty, or burden of accessing, exchanging, or using EHI. I think the question came up in this work group about non-standard, and that language, I believe, is from CURES, so we took that from there, and we describe what we mean in preamble. The costs associated with intangible assets, opportunity costs, except for the reasonable forward-looking cost of capital, The fee prohibited by 45 CFR 164.524C4, which has to, it's from the HIPAA privacy rule and has to do with providing copies of EPHI under HIPAA. So you couldn't have a fee that's prohibited by that, but it is an important distinction that we don't contradict HIPAA. Those fees allowable under that section are allowed. What we're saying is a patient should have free access to their electronic health information. A fee based in any part on the individual's electronic access to their EHI, so that's what I was just talking about. Six is what relates to the topic from the full task force meeting earlier, a fee to perform an export of EHI via the capability of Health IT certified to the B10 criteria for full data export or EHI export for the purposes of switching Health IT or to provide patients with their EHI. And then lastly, a fee to export or convert data from an EHR technology unless such fee was agreed to in writing at the time the technology was acquired. We also, an important point to mention here is that, you know, we tried to be consistent and clear throughout in our approach, and we felt that, you know, it made a lot of sense to describe the methodology that would need to be used to recover costs and then to exclude certain costs. But if others have ideas about ways to clarify our approach, we definitely welcome them. With that, maybe I'll stop since this is the end of this exception, see if anyone has any comments or questions. Okay, great.
Nope, good. Carry on.
All right, great. All right, so the next one we're going to talk about, next slide, is licensing of interoperability elements on reasonable and non-discriminatory terms. So as we talked about in our work group, the difference here between 204 is that we're talking about licensing of interoperability elements, which are essentially, it's a broad term. We've talked about how we define it broadly.
Sorry, hold on. I apologize because I do actually have a question that I've just been puzzling over. So I think I've already noted that my interpretation of recovering cost does not allow for profit. I think the preamble notes that the intent of ONC was to allow for a reasonable profit. Is there a defined term for recovering costs and you know, relevant to, for example, GAAP accounting standards or other kinds of interpretive guidance where the term recovering costs that ONC was contemplating, if there's a reasonable definition of that anywhere? I used the word reasonable again.
Yeah, I don't know that I can speak to that. I will say that we looked at GAAP and other approaches, and we felt that the approach we took was appropriate for the information blocking context and provided the appropriate kind of flexibility that we were looking for. Again, you know, if there is a specific concept or term within GAAP or other accounting, you know, approaches, we welcome those comments if you have a thought on improvement.
No, just appreciate that. All I'm just looking for is there something I'm missing where, you know, there's a definition that you may or may not have been following that if only I understood that all the light bulbs would go off. It doesn't sound like there is.
So, I mean, I think all I can really say is that our interpretation of the language you put in there is that reasonable profits would be included within the exceptions for costs reasonably incurred and brand licensing. Yep.
Yep, got it. Thank you.
Sure. Just a point, though, Arian. I mean, it does sound like we both – it sounds like you're in agreement of our you know, what we're trying to get at. Maybe you just are saying that you want to suggest a clarification or perhaps a different, slightly different approach, but – That's my interpretation of what you're saying.
No, that's right. So I think in any case, I'd be asking for potentially changes in the regulatory text to clarify these points. I think there's probably some, you know, maybe some more wholesale revisions that we'll suggest. But I think with respect to cost recovery, I think we'll be making, or at least I'll be making some comments and already have relative to clarifying the reg text. Thanks.
Sure. Sure. Yeah. Okay. Let me.
Mark and Sandy. Yeah. I just want to echo Arian there. I suspect that whilst we understand the intent, and we may or may not agree with the intent, but we understand it. Certainly, I think the way it's manifested right now is not as clear as you explain. Notwithstanding the fact that the use of the word reasonable here, I appreciate it's used elsewhere, but defining what's a reasonable cost, it is fairly subjective. So trying to work out how we could make some recommendations to aid in clarity, both for those who are claiming these to be costs, but and also those who are trying to gauge whether they are reasonable or not. So, yeah, I think there is some more thinking that's going in here.
Yeah, no, I think that's great. And we I keep saying it, yeah, but we welcome those comments. We our goal here with all the exceptions is to be clear about what we expect, the expectations are of the market and of actors, and it's not trying to trick anybody. So we want to be really
That's fine. No, I get that. And also, frankly, I'm not sure the intent you had was to enable you to go on a voyage of discovery and opening up the books of commercial organizations to ascertain whether the costs they're claiming are reasonable or not.
Yeah, well, I guess all I would say is, I think we're...
Well, was that the intent?
What I'll say is, I think our intent, as I pointed out, was to promote innovation and competition, and we provide, I think a number of examples in both of these exception sections about what types of situations would or would not constitute reasonable or in the context of the exceptions. But again, if you read the preamble and you read the reg text, then it's still... not clear or not aligned with what you think is the right approach, then we definitely would like to hear those comments.
Yeah, you may just disabuse me of this perception, if I'm wrong, or you think I'm wrong. The preamble considers the nature of the costs as opposed to the level of the costs. So it looks and says, these are reasonable types of things that you could expect to have costs on. But it doesn't say, this is what we think of as a reasonable level that cost could rise to. I think that's maybe the gap.
Right. I mean, perhaps. I wasn't sure if that was a question or comment. But, I think we don't prescribe, the amount that people can charge. And again, this was in conjunction with conversations we had with FTC and OIG about both what makes sense from a policy perspective, but also as far as enforcement goes, you need to be able to apply, the proposals we put in the proposed rule, and then eventually in the final rule. So those were our considerations, welcome thoughts on how to improve it.
Okay, thanks.
All right. Does anyone else have any comments? All right. So as far as the RAND licensing goes, we talked about this in a previous work group, and what the key distinction here is that we're talking about licensing of the interoperability elements, which is that broad term that we use about the means by which you can access the EHI you're trying to get. Some of the stuff that we were thinking about here with this one was, IP rights can be misused in ways that really undermine the promotion of competition and innovation. And there is a really high potential for abuse when the IP rights pertain to functional aspects of health IT that are needed to enable interoperability. And this was based off of stakeholder meetings and research and studies and all of everything we've put into this work for the last 4 years or so, or even longer probably. So under this one, it will not be information blocking for an actor to interfere with access exchange or use by limiting access to an interoperability element, so long as that element is available for use by those that need it on reasonable and non-discriminatory terms. As we talked about, the terminology or the approach to use RAND is generally used in court cases for standards. We looked at it and we thought that the approach made sense and fit well, and we adjusted it a bit, but generally speaking, we adapted it for our purposes and felt like there was precedent to use it. Not precedent to use it, but there was it was a standard that has been used and fit well. As far as the process here on this slide, there's the timely response that's required. There's the offering of an appropriate license, and we've talked about this one that you all might want to tweak the time frame for that. And again, just to emphasize, it's not actually agreeing on a license, but it's just the first reasonable offer, RAND offer being made. And then there's some additional requirements I'll talk about, and there has to be compliance with the relevant conditions of certification. And again, just to emphasize to Arian's point, our intent is that reasonable profits would be allowed under this exception as well. Next slide.
Actually, before you go there, sure. The applicability, I think we got into some naughty details, but the applicability of the RAND licensing is to an actor. So if there's a non-actor whose license or grant or IP is essential to interoperability, they would not right now fall under the reasonable the RAND licensing terms. So the example that I've given in the past, I'm stating this just for purpose of clarification. So the example I've given in the past is, let's say, a medical society that comes up with procedural terminology that's endorsed or used by the nation's largest payer. But that actor is not an actor as defined by CURES or by the CURES NPRM, I don't think. Maybe I got that wrong. And then that actor is not also an SDO relative to some of the sub-licensing terms that occur in that section. So again, I'm just stating this to make sure I understand it well. If my understanding would be that fees that that actor, I shouldn't use the word actor, fees that that entity might charge would not be, I guess they'd be cost reasonably incurred rather than IPR. But how does, let me just also, I'm thinking out loud and I apologize. Let me also, so first of all, do I understand that right? And then secondly, does ONC or does the proposed rule have a perspective on licensing, IPR licensing that is standards essential or essential for access, exchange, and use, where that licensing is not by an actor as defined under the rule? So two-part question, and apologies for thinking aloud as I was talking.
Yeah, so I think I'm understanding, but I'll frame it this way, and I think you were asking some similar questions or scenarios in the earlier session. I think they're great ways for us to think through some of these issues. The way that I look at any of these cases, and I'm going back to that elements of information blocking checklist that was on the slide deck previously, there are certain things that you look at to see, am I information blocking under the Cures Act and under the regulation? Are you an actor regulated by the provision? So we talk about how there's developers, providers, networks, and exchanges laid out in Cures. And we have defined in our rule what those actors, who those actors are. If you fall under one of those categories as we define them, then you would be considered an actor who would be potentially on the hook. Is there EHI involved as we define it? And again, you have to look at our definition to see if it falls under our definition. Is the practice likely to interfere with, prevent, or materially discourage access, exchange, or use? So is the conduct you're doing going to interfere with the access, exchange, or use? There is the requisite knowledge of an actor to whether you're a provider or a developer, network, or exchange. And then we'd look at whether the blocking is required by law or it's covered by an exception. So, I can't really interpret or get into the details of these specific fact patterns, but that's the framework that we're working under to determine if it's information blocking.
Got it. Helpful. Thank you.
Sure. And I'd refer you, I think we're going to post those slides pretty soon on our website. And I think that slide specifically will be helpful for folks just to frame the issues. You know, I think there's a lot of, like Arian has talked about and others have talked about, these fringe issues that you're thinking about that you're not quite sure. And we want to hear if we missed the mark at all or we haven't created the right balance. So I think that one would be helpful. So maybe just a quick example I'll provide about a scenario under the RAND licensing. This one would be implicated if an actor were to assert proprietary rights in medical vocabularies or code sets in a way that was likely to interfere with the access exchange or use. So that would be a problematic situation that you could try to qualify for the exception, but that's a use case that we were thinking, one of the many, many ones that we were thinking about as problematic. I won't get into the definition of interoperability element because that was covered, I think, in the session earlier today, but it is quite broad. All right, next slide. Oh, yeah, I'm already on the next slide. Sorry, previous slide. I was still on the last one. Okay, real quickly, we've talked about this already, but there's a timely response requirement where after receiving the request to license or use the elements, the actor must respond to the request or within 10 business days from receipt of the request. And the way we, in the preamble, describe this response, it's two-pronged. You have to negotiate with the requester in a RAND fashion to identify the elements that are needed and also offering a RAND license or a license on RAND terms. And then I won't get into this because we've talked about this quite a bit and they're laid out here, but these are the components of a RAND license that we require and that we've talked about. A few points, though, I guess, for clarity, as far as reasonable royalty. In preamble, we talk about how it would need to be non-discriminatory, based solely on the independent value of the actor's technology to the licensee's products, and consistent with the policies of the standards development organization through which it was licensed, if that's applicable. So I just wanted to make that point because I know reasonable royalty was a point of conversation. So does anyone have any thoughts on this slide before I move on to the last slide? All right, great. So we're on to the next one, which I believe is the last one I'll be talking about. And here are some additional requirements that go along with the previous slide. So to qualify for this exception, the actor must not engage in any practice that has any of the following purposes or effects. And again, our intent here was to identify, this is the conduct that we want to be on the lookout for and should not be allowed. So impeding the efficient use of the interoperability elements to access, exchange, or use EHI for any purpose for which a person is authorized, permitted, or required to access, exchange, or use the EHI under applicable law. Impeding the efficient development, distribution, deployment, or use of an interoperability product or service for which there is an actual or potential demand. And then also making changes that break compatibility or otherwise degrade the performance. So, this overall, these exceptions were intended, like I've said, to promote innovation and competition and interoperability overall, and to make it easier to access, exchange, use information when there's a good reason to do so. Does anyone have any questions? Yep.
Does anyone have any questions?
I have lots of thinking out loud, but probably no questions.
Or thoughts. I mean, I'm not sure
Where I get a little stuck is, it is one thing to impede access. So if I'm impeding access, then I am sort of standing athwart the record as it exists. it's harder for me to understand what materially impedes exchange or use, and in particular the way that use is defined. It's basically interpreting, getting value out of, incorporating. There's a broad definition of the term use, and it occurs to me that there might be a different standard that's required for access than for exchange or use, in the sense that there's a whole lot more value-added services that are associated with exchange or use that I would believe, but I think sort of objectively, are less problematic than the same, for example, fee structures applied to access, where you are truly impeding the underlying access to the data. So that's kind of my thinking out loud, is we may want to think about comment that tailors the requirements more narrowly to the classes of activities that are more or less problematic.
Well, and I'm not sure if you're able, I'm trying to figure out how to make it bigger, but I pulled up the slide that we had in the previous deck from this morning where we talk about how we define access, exchange, or use.
I've been all over those definitions as well.
Yeah, and just a note, I know you know this, Arian, but for everyone on the line, is that those terms are taken straight from Cures. And again, we looked at what Cures was saying, and we came up with these definitions based on, you know, common understanding of the terms, but also within the context of information blocking.
Yep.
You know, but if I try and think this through to an example, then where we've got, let's say, a health information exchange who is routinely exchanging information, so they're providing access, but they don't actually ever touch the semantic of the data itself. And so they're allowing the exchange, they're enabling the exchange, but that data is borderline unusable by some of the recipients because of the semantics inside it. So they can do exchange, they can enable access, but they're not enabling use. Would they then fall foul of the provisions? Go on.
Not to throw it back at you, but believe throughout Cures it's an or. So it's access, exchange, or use. So it's not all three. It's just, you know, one of them.
Yeah. So you're entitled to throw it back at me. That's fine. So by that definition, then they would be complicit. They would certainly implicate the information blocking regulation because they're not enabling the free use. Curious one.
Yeah. The direction that I go, Andy, in that with the same example is so. You know, in full disclosure, I have run and operated results exchanges. And as part of the work that we've done in operating results exchanges, we have interfaced with EHR vendors, many of which, and generally we would do a pass-through relative to interface fees, but many of which do charge substantial interface fees. For just opening an interface. And then on top of that, we do a whole set of activities, including mapping coding terminology, making sure that when the lab says provider A, that we map that to a known provider as an endpoint. Et cetera. So there's a whole set of, mapping, yeah, remapping between one person's interpretation of an HL7 ORU and somebody else's interpretation of an HL7 ORU. So a whole set of activities there. The thought process that I have is that there is one set of behaviors And if I think about the EHR on the other end that has an expensive interface fee, it's hard for me to understand how much of that fee is associated with making the data available versus mapping or, you know, causing to be mapped proprietary data.
Making it usable, yeah.
Making it usable. And then likewise, on my side, to your point, I could just deliver the message as is, but it wouldn't be terribly usable for the recipient. So the work that I do to transform it and recode it and blah, 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 that makes it useful for the recipient seems to me a less problematic set of activities that I'm doing with respect to information blocking than if I said, this EHR can get it, but that EHR can't because that EHR competes with me. Or if I put in place provisions that were discriminatory in terms of who could or couldn't access it. So those are the thought processes that I have in terms of, you know, how do we carve our way through this thicket and address the policy constraint without impeding activities that are non-problematic and helpful for the HIT for the healthcare industry.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I was going to say I agree with that. You know, I think that's exactly what we are trying to do and to strike that right balance. So sorry, Andy.
Okay.
Yeah, we need to be thoughtful in that we don't inadvertently start preventing some activities which are, you know, they're good activities. Straightforward exchange of data is a good thing. Some organizations, you know, I mean, not every organization is as enlightened as you are. But some organizations certainly have commercial models where they exchange information, but they don't actually touch the data at all. They don't touch the semantic at all. Would we inadvertently with this rule, or maybe intentionally with this rule, be determining that those organizations are not sufficiently creating utility? That would be a difficult statement to make, I think.
Oh, I'd agree with that too.
But the awe nature of some of these makes it particularly tricky.
Yeah, as I said, from a policy perspective, I think it's far more problematic to impede access. To charge a fee for access than it is to charge a fee for exchange or use. And it is far more problematic to have IPR that impedes exchange or use. So if I have to license IPR in order to meaningfully exchange or downstream use a piece of information, that's a far more problematic behavior or activity than if I purchase technology to remap or recode data that's a value add on top of the bare record. So I try to get at these cases where, you know, if what we're doing is standing athwart the bare record and making the bare record less interpretable or less useful, that seems like it's and not accessible. Those seem like bad activities that we want to stop. To the extent that we're taking the bare record and plus upping it, making it better, making it more valuable, adding more semantics to it in ways that are valuable to end users that they want to pay for, that seems to be less problematic. And I just think we need to find a policy framework that is better tuned for that distinction.
Is there a difference, Alan, between an organization who elects not to utilize the semantic translation function, as opposed to an organization that couldn't, even if they wanted, could, because it's not available to them?
Right. So one way to think about this is that if I'm a provider, let's say I run a lab, and some labs make available a set of services and technologies that get the lab result all the way into the EHR. Some labs might choose to stop at publishing an interface and saying, hey, I made it accessible, come at it. But it's not actually exchangeable in practice. So maybe this is where you're going, which is, what are the obligations of an actor with respect to making it accessible, exchangeable, and usable? And then, you know, what are the obligations of whatever service provider they do or don't use in terms of what fee structure they can or can't charge in order to do that?
No, you're right. It's kind of where I am going. It's like, we use these three terms, you know, exchangeable, accessible, and usable, okay? All three, and there's an and in the middle. It's not exchangeable, accessible, or usable. It's and. So the implication seems to be that to be determined not to be information blocking, you have to satisfy all those three things. And if that's the case, then I can, hey, you and I know of organizations right now that will routinely exchange information, but they deliberately say, we're not going to touch the contents of that data because, for whatever reason. And it's up to the recipient organization to be able to translate and make use of it and make that data understandable and into truly understandable information. It certainly seems like that's the intent of this.
I think it's important, Andy, just to remember that what we're looking at is from the standpoint of interference with access exchange or use. We're not looking at what they... We're looking at if they are interfering with access or exchange or use, whether it's a reasonable and necessary activity. But it sounds like what you're talking about is kind of flipped, maybe. But I'm not sure if I'm understanding that.
Well, maybe I am.
This is Anil. Yeah, I was just going to say that the example that I would probably give, maybe this helps, at least helps me understand this better. But if a system had in there a set of blood pressures, and also had in there how those blood pressures were taken. Was the patient lying down? Were they sitting? Were they standing? And they chose from that system only to transmit the blood pressures without the context of whether they were standing, sitting, or lying down. To me, that is information blocking, because the recipient of those blood pressures can't use it. They don't know whether the patient was sitting, standing, or lying down. Now, if that system didn't collect whether they were sitting, standing, or lying down, then that's not information blocking, because that information didn't exist in any electronic form. But I think the intent here should be that if you have information that helps someone understand how to use the information that's being accessed, exchanged, and you withhold it, then that's information blocking. Now, if you didn't have it to begin with, then you're not really interfering, and therefore it's not information blocking. Is that?
Well, yes. So this is where we come down to these naughty issues of, let's say, to continue example on blood pressure monitoring, I come up with an AI algorithm that correlates blood pressure changes over time with risk for events.
Passing out. Sure.
And well, I'm more thinking ischemic events, but whatever. Doesn't matter what the algorithm is. So I've got an algorithm that I've created that takes those raw facts and creates additional value on top of those raw facts. Is it information blocking for me to charge a price, charge a high price for that capability, charge a price that's well above the bare cost that I have that might have been some compute time, because it's a valuable service that nobody else can do? Or, you know, is it a required element of interpretation of the blood pressures, and it's essential for use? It is a use, and any fee that I charge that's not, you know, kind of a cost plus fee is ipso facto information blocking.
Well, I would probably say that if that model was used for decision making, for patient decision making, and was part of the medical record, then
I'm
I think it
there.
Is information blocking not to share that.
No, I'm with you there. If it's
sense?
Part of the designated record set, if it's part of the legal medical record,
then
now, if
and
you
it's actually used by the clinician, absolutely we'd
yeah,
be there.
Yeah. All right. So now let's assume that it's not part of the legal medical record. You get a series of blood pressures, and now you have a business of value-added services where you are now adding a risk score onto it, the
mm-hmm.
risk of ischemia, as you put it. Then I think you should be allowed to generate revenue from that. I think the part of where you should not be allowed to do anything silly would be to take those original raw data and try to monetize that. I think the monetization
Amen.
Should
I am
only
so,
be...
I'm so with you.
Yeah. I think
and, we all agree with that.
But I should be able to charge whatever price I want to as long as my
the market,
counterparty pay
yeah,
for
the market,
it. But
right.
I should
the
not.
The market will figure that out.
That's right. But I should not further impede the use of the raw blood pressure values. So I think we're all in agreement of the policy intent.
Yeah. I think that where we've
done... Let's go back to Neil's example of the blood pressure case just for a moment. So let's say that a transfer of care takes place and those blood pressure readings are wrapped up inside a CCD or something and are exchanged with the organization that's receiving the patient for continuity of care. However, the coding behind those is actually some localized form, okay? And the receiving organization doesn't understand those blood pressure readings. Would that count as information blocking?
So, Andy, if you remember this convoluted definition that I sent out to a number of people,
yes.
I'm happy to share it more broadly. One of the things that I believed should be covered in the definition of information blocking impeding access is any transformation that's associated with surfacing data in a certified standard. So if I've certified my health information technology, so let me give you my results example. Because this is a real example. There are, EHRs have ORU interfaces, and EHRs implement proprietary coding terminologies. But they are required to support the LRI spec that has data available via LOINC. If a certified EHR technology is certified to use the LRI spec and certified to receive data via LOINC and goes through ONC ATC testing of that, but then charges a fee for every interface for remapping LOINC to their own proprietary codes, that to me constitutes an unallowable fee under the non-standard implementation. I would extend the obligation to provide the bare facts of the legal medical record. As Anil notes, in cases where facts, value-added facts were used for decision-making, they're part of the bare facts of the legal medical record. And in cases where some level of transformation is required to adhere to a standard that I've certified to, that's on me as adhering to that certified standard to be able to provide any of that mapping. Sorry, again, long drawn out thought process.
I think we're saying no.
Speaking. Yeah, I'm saying no. I am saying no. That's not an allowed call. That's not an allowed. It is. It should be required of that actor to do the work to surface it in the proposed standard or in the certified standard.
Yeah, I mean, I think the alternative is that anyone who wants to block data would simply create their own ontology and hide behind it. So I think that,
yep.
that the only answer can be that you're required, where an appropriate standard exists, to use that standard when you exchange.
Okay, and the same goes for if there's an intermediary sitting in the middle, like a health information exchange, they are also obligated to do so.
Yeah.
No. Wait. Hold on.
I received it coded in Arian's Magic Standard, and Andy wants to receive it in SnowMed CT. Well, who's the fault there?
Wait a minute. You can't. If the HIE is simply bringing data in from Arian. Well, the HIE and Arian, would be where the transaction would occur. And the HIE could accuse Arian of information blocking, right?
Yep.
If you now want that data from the HIE, whatever the HIE is exposing, whatever they have is the limits of what they could be accused of information blocking. They can't be accused of blocking information that they don't have.
I agree with you, and we need to be clear about that.
Then. Oh, okay.
Yeah, so okay. So Andy, I would say in that sense, if the HIE is certified to, for example, an IHE or fire-based information exchange standard, that I can't charge an unreasonable cost for every XCPD or fire equivalent interface that I do. I can charge a reasonable cost to hook up to my HIE. Yeah.
Now you're in the space of where there's the HIE is leveraging a product. So the HIE organization is leveraging an HIE product, which has been developed by a third party. And that product is well capable of doing this. However, the HIE themselves, as is the case in the US, some do, some don't, have elected to not do any translation of data.
Yeah,
let
me give you the example of Commonwell. So Commonwell is a service that I'm the service provider for. Commonwell is a not-for-profit organization. And there are some activities that Commonwell does, like patient matching and linking, like when we do record retrieval, we retrieve out to a whole number of endpoints and we consolidate the results back so that there's a single information feed. But we don't do anything to the content.
Yep.
So with respect to Commonwealth, the interface to Commonwealth is defined by the Commonwealth standards, none of which are defined in terms of the resulting content. We're just as happy to ship you a PDF or a consolidated CDA or an HL7 document. We don't get into that business. But if there's an unreasonable fee or if there's any competitive behavior that we do, now, relative to who can join and who can't join, if we excluded arbitrarily, EHR vendors from the upper Midwest, then that would constitute information blocking. If we charged implementation fees that were egregiously above and beyond the cost of implementation, or if we charge differential implementation fees that were unconnected to the complexity of hooking up to the network, those would be problematic behaviors. But choosing to say our interface is defined as X, Y, and Z, but not Y, is not itself information blocking.
It's a curious one given the use of the word utility. Because it's it's an or in the middle of all that.
Andy, what do you mean by that? I'm not sure I understand.
Okay, I'm not giving an opinion. I'm having this is a discussion right now still. Where we talk about exchange, access, or use, or and use, sorry, the implication, I think, is you need to be permitting all three or facilitating all three to be information sharing, and therefore, if you're not facilitating all three, you're guilty of blocking, potentially, or
no,
implicated
that's not,
in blocking.
No,
I don't think that's... I was going to say, I don't think it means that you're facilitating all three. I think it means that you're not blocking any one of them. It's different.
Yeah, and Andy, if you look at Cures, I think it's important to look at the context in Cures. It says, discourage access, exchange, or use. So we're talking about an or, and we're talking about like an interference of some sort. That's the context.
Yeah. No, I agree with you. I'm just working out how we're going to give recommendations, which make this very, very clear.
I look forward to those.
Stop it. Okay, guys, carry on.
Well, so Andy, what do you want to do? So on the agenda, I think we're about an hour in here, and
yeah,
we still haven't talked about the additional proposals for, you know, the request for information, if you guys have additional exceptions, complaint process, and the disincentives request for information. Do you want to try to get through those, or do you want to stick with...
Let's go to the additional exceptions first and see if we can bang through those. Let's go there.
Okay, do you want me to pull up on my screen, or just we can talk
about it? Yeah, you can pull it up. We'll go talk around it as we go through it. So, Val, Arian, Anil, do we actually think there are additional exceptions that we require? Actually, while we're at it, we'll just quickly discuss whether the reasonable costs and the royalty exceptions, whether they actually, we think maybe they should stay as exceptions, or should they be put into their own section or not?
Can you restate that question?
Yeah, so should the what are currently drafted is the exceptions around reasonable costs and royalties, whether they should actually be sitting in a separate section around appropriate financial transactions or something like that.
I think it would be clearer if there was a single fee exception.
Okay. Or a single,
because otherwise it gets confused. And this is relative to my comment that we need to do a better job of helping people determine which fees are or are not subject to information blocking regulation, and
yep,
what subparts of those fees are or not allowable.
Okay, I think that's probably, what do you and Anil think?
It seems like that might be a little bit clearer.
Yeah, agree.
So I think Arian, you're suggesting collapsing into a single exception around fees.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, my original question was whether we should actually suggest that it's separate from the rest of the exceptions, and that it covers reasonable fees that can be charged, as opposed to, I'm not sure whether exceptions is the right language for fees.
That's a Cures thing, and I'm not sure that ONC is going to be able to get around it. But I do find it more helpful to think about allowable practices than exceptions to information blocking.
Totally.
It amounts to the same thing.
Yeah, I do too. I agree. Okay, so let's just take that as something for our drafting. The additional exceptions. Mr. Team, are any thoughts on that?
Well, I've already commented probably duplicatively about better understanding BAA terms, in particular BAA data use terms, with mm-hmm. respect to information blocking. My general statement is that I would prefer a policy framework that is permissive and allows data to flow. I recognize that HIPAA allows covered entities that BAs only have the rights that are granted to them by covered entities under BAA terms, and that those data use grants would restrict the BA's ability to comply with information blocking. And, you know, as a BA, I don't want to be in the middle. I want it to be clear.
On the BAA subject, you know, elsewhere, and in one of the other work groups, we've been discussing where, you know, obviously a BAA is normally adjunct to a contract, and obligations for the rewriting or the assessing and potential rewriting and reagreement of contracts, which may impinge upon information sharing. And obviously BAAs would fall under that. Is that germane to your point?
Can you state that again? You said a bunch of obviouslys, and I was having a hard time going down with the obviouslys.
Okay, so obviously it wasn't so obvious. Okay. BAAs are broadly considered to, I'll make a statement and see if you agree with it. BAAs are broadly considered to be contractual between two entities. Okay, and they are normally adjunct to a contract being agreed. There are obligations elsewhere inside the regulations around the way that contracts need to be assessed and re-agreed, where they may impinge upon the ability to share information appropriately. And BAAs then would be part of that, those conversations as well.
I don't follow that chain of logic. So there's a okay. I have reviewed the preamble to the rule to look at every instance of the word contract. And my belief is that the problematic contractual terms that ONC has pointed out in the preamble are relating to, for example, gag clauses relative to safety issues or other kinds of problematic EHR contractual behavior. But I'm not aware of anywhere in the preamble where this tension between HIPAA and data use rights granted to BAs and information blocking and the obligations of Health Information Network are actually discussed or adjudicated. So the statement that you're going down is a statement that presumes that the information blocking requirements trump the BAA terms, but I'd prefer that to be explicitly stated.
Well, I agree with you. There's no presumption right here. It's a discussion point. So under like 174.03, which is around the communications and condition certification, etc., you touch upon the business practices developers related to exchanging electronic health information. And within that as well, there's the whole maintenance of certification, which has, as currently drafted, within 1 year of the final rule, any communication or contract provision will not be enforced by the developer, and then within 2 years, that would be amended. I'm not sure how you and your organisation generally contract. I know me and mine, we generally have the BAA as an appendices to a contract, so by inclusion, it will be wrapped up. Maybe this is an area that we feel that should be deliberately carved out.
My general comment would be it's an area that needs to be made clear.
And what do we think our recommendation on that clarity would be?
My preference?
Yeah, that's a good starter.
Just recognize that a provider who has negotiated BAA data use terms very deliberately may have a different preference. But my preference would be to, with respect to the bare facts of the record, whether the designated record set's the right term or not, my preference would be to, for permissible purposes, to share as broadly as possible. And so my preference would be to override BAA terms. A provider organization may feel...
You broke up there. To me, you broke up and you went blank,
okay.
Override data use terms. I'm like, what?
My preference would be to have a clear preemption. A provider organization who has negotiated very specific data use rights may feel otherwise. And, you know, all of this is subject to HIPAA minimization or, you know, minimization of use. So I just think there's a lot that needs to get adjudicated and a lot of perspectives, I think, that need to be collected with respect to that preference.
Okay, so let's ask the man at the moment, Mark, what is the intent in the current drafted regulation around an artifact like a BAA? If that BAA is restrictive of information sharing.
Yeah, so, I mean, Arian's right. We don't explicitly talk about BAAs for the most part, except within the regulatory impact analysis. You know, we have some language I can direct you to on page 365 to 366, where we talk about restrictions on access, exchange, or use. I'll read it. Maybe it's helpful. One means by which actors may restrict access, exchange, or use of EHIs through formal restrictions. These may be expressed in contract or license terms, EHI sharing policies, organizational policies or procedures, or other instruments or documents that set forth requirements related to EHI or health IT. Additionally, in the absence of express contractual restriction, an actor may achieve the same result by exercising intellectual property or other rights in ways that restrict access, exchange, or use. So we view these all I'm saying is that we're pretty clear, I think, in preamble that we view contractual obligations that restrict the access, exchange, or use of EHI outside of reasonable and necessary activities as problematic and cases that could be information blocking.
Got it.
Okay.
Super helpful.
Do you treat BAAs as being a matter of contract?
Well, so I can't speak to interpreting that. I can only say what we have in the preamble. Go ahead.
That was an either-or question.
What'd you say?
You have not?
I have or I have not.
In the preamble as matters of contract.
Well, all I'll say is we don't specifically talk about BAAs, but we do talk about the problematic nature of contracts and policies, procedures, sharing policies, all that, license terms, all those different restrictions that we saw when we talked to stakeholders.
Yeah, I think 365 is super informative. The commentary through page 365 is super helpful.
Great.
Make me scroll to it now, aren't you? 365. Okay, well, it talks about other instruments. That seems to imply BAAs.
I think you could certainly read it that way.
Yeah. So that's my original point, Harry, in that, you know, BAAs would not be a permissible exception.
Well, and just... Again, just to be
I'm not asking you for interpretation.
Oh I know that. No, I was going to say there is not an exception. We, you know, just to be clear, that we have the seven exceptions, but there is not one for BAAs currently.
And I'm trying to get to the bottom about whether we on the task force are suggesting that there should be or not.
This is Anil. I don't think there should be. I mean, I think that's one of the biggest criticisms in the market right now is that the BAAs are used to prevent information blocking. I think all the examples that Arian mentioned last time aside, I think that is one of the one of the challenges in the market today. So if anything, if we're going to comment on BAAs, is to maybe clarify the language a bit more, put them in context, maybe give them more time to be renegotiated. But I think the idea that we somehow create an exception because the BAA was written not to promote information sharing, I think would be going in the wrong direction, in my opinion.
And that's certainly the direction that's been considered in work group three around this, Anil. And actually, just so you know, the contract re-discussion opening up, as the recommendation is to go from 2 years to 5 years, just because of the level of discussions that might be required, and the fact that some organisations have very large numbers of these contracts in place, and it's going to take time. Okay, Arian.
But to be clear, I also don't think that in the time that it takes to renegotiate those, that they should be allowed to engage in behavior that would be considered information blocking. Okay. The clock starts right, within that 2 year period or whatever it is. What's that?
Yeah, the clock starts when the regulation starts.
Right. But that you have time to renegotiate, but it doesn't mean you can still hide behind it, even if you haven't renegotiated.
Yeah, I'm just looking to see that the actual language was that they drafted. Actually, I think that's, you probably raised a point that needs to go back into that group, because right now they've drafted up that within 2 years you'll agree a plan to amend the contract. Mark, I can't remember whether there was original language relieving the obligations which are blocking in the meantime. I can't remember.
I don't believe you guys specified that. I do believe that the current proposal from ONC's perspective, the 2 years, I need to look at it specifically, but I don't think it means that you can still have these bad contracts for 2 years regarding communications. Like I think it's similar to what Anil's saying, but I need to look.
I found it. Actually, it says in the meantime, a health IT developer must not establish or enforce any contract or agreement that contravenes it. So it's enforced.
But Andy, to your point, I think it's worth bringing up with that group just to make sure that they're on the same page with that point that we proposed.
Yeah, can you make a note to do that? Just because we've nearly finished with that group. So.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah, actually, yeah, that group's updated the paragraph to actually say a health IT developer must not establish, renew, or enforce any contractual agreement that contravenes paragraph A. So the enforcement is definitely in their redrafting as well, but we should just mention that. Okay, cool. Where would be the appropriate place to, at least in the preamble, mention the BAA? It sounds like probably over in communications on section 17403. Is that the right place?
I think it needs to be more explicit in the rule.
Okay.
And then with respect to, the preamble and the final rule, appropriate commentary. And then also, just to be clear, I believe that because of the definition of EHI, this is not a broad giveaway of unrestricted access to de-identified data or data for sale or data for secondary use. This is really with respect to access to data for permissible uses.
That's my understanding too. I'll take that as mute agreement.
Yeah, This is Neil. I was just thinking, I just want to make sure I understand what you mean by secondary use, because I think there is language in there that you're talking about in the BAAs about secondary use. Are you speaking specifically about the BAAs, Aaron?
Yeah, so among the...
Okay, yeah, that's cool.
That's right.
I just want to make sure we're not talking about one of the other exceptions where it strictly prevents someone from blocking data because of the secondary use that the recipient might get.
Yeah, that's right.
Okay, all right.
Well, I think we're all in agreement that BAAs are not an exception. So we're not going
to
propose them as one. Phew, I thought for a moment there, Anil, you were saying they maybe should be. Was that,
No. I think that's the biggest problem I've seen in the market right now, actually.
Okay. Are there any legitimate exceptions? I know that I mentioned, or we mentioned, national security exceptions earlier. I don't know whether, Mark, you've managed to get the diligence done around that, given this has been a fairly busy week with other things.
Sorry, the question was national security exception?
Yeah, did you do the background to find out whether actually no special exceptions required, it's all covered, or is that still pending?
Well, I think I kind of looked into it, but maybe I'm not understanding the question. So it's not currently an exception. So if, I guess maybe a fact pattern that you're thinking of could be helpful, but generally,
okay, we're only going to make recommendations for exceptions where there isn't an existing path to an exception.
Right. And, yeah, the natural one would be where prohibited by law. If it's prohibited by law to exchange information deemed confidential or whatever the appropriate classification is, then classified or, you know, whatever the appropriate classification is, then that would that be covered under the required by law exception?
Yeah, we just want to make sure that there isn't any unintended consequence of orders of precedence around law or whatever. We just want to make sure.
Yeah.
Or
so
do we need to include it as an exception?
Yeah. So just to clarify. So the way that this is written is that if there's an interference by an actor with the access exchange or use, like I said, you go through that checklist, and then if you got down to whether there's an exception, you'd have to fit into one of those exceptions or be required by law. When we talk about required by law, we're talking specifically to interferences with access exchange or use of EHI that are explicitly required by state or federal law. I think in the preamble we distinguish, well, we definitely do. I think it's within the privacy exception. We talk about, we distinguish between different interferences that are required by law and those that are pursuant to a privacy law, which is not considered required by law. So that's an example of where we're saying, you know, it has to be an explicit requirement that has to do with access, exchange, or use. And I can find the page number, but the discussion in the privacy exception might be helpful for understanding what we mean. So basically, Andy, to your question, whatever the fact pattern is, if it, you know, we'd look to whether it's required by law to interfere or whether it meets an exception. If it doesn't fall under those categories, as it's currently written, it could be considered information blocking and subject to penalties or disincentives.
We get that. I'm trying to ascertain whether it feels like a very legitimate reason to block him.
You're underwater, Andy.
Oh, well, in so many ways. What I'm trying to understand is a legitimate reason. If we think there is a legitimate reason for information not to be shared, i.e.
Yeah.
for a national security purpose, whether that is already taken care of elsewhere in other legislation, which we will obviously comply with, or whether actually it needs to be explicitly called out in here. That's what I'm trying to understand.
Well, so, yeah, I mean, just my thought, like I said, we only have the exceptions. If there's a scenario that you can think of where there wouldn't be a requirement by law and it wouldn't be covered by one of these exceptions like privacy, security, infeasibility, things like that, then you might want to recommend.
Yeah, absolutely. With it, look, good example with the new large EMRs going in at both DoD and VA, and one of the key rationales for having the same EMR platform but used in both is to enable interoperability between the DoD and the VA. So it seems logical to presume that information around the care that's been tendered to an individual when they're in service will also be on their record when they're being cared for by the VA. And given that a large chunk of the care that the VA provides is actually paid for in comes from the commercial world. So those records will be available in the commercial world. So you've theoretically got access to data that was out in the commercial world that was actually two hops removed, created when they were serving personnel. Now, it seems logical that there may be aspects of those service records which could be held to be especially sensitive and that should not be routinely shared. But we wouldn't want that to inadvertently fall under the definition of information blocking when it's actually a national security issue. Is that a good example? Was that an understandable example? Let's not be too subjective on good yet.
Yeah, I think it's a good example. And I don't know that I can give it the answer you want just because it really depends on those specific facts and circumstances. I think it could fall under a security exception. It could, I guess, infeasibility could be in play. I mean, I don't really know unless I looked at what the specific EHR
well, I wouldn't
was
say,
the
but,
actors
okay, I wouldn't say feasibility. Look, take it from me. Feasibility is not the issue. The issue is actually whether the VA and DoD will want to redact that information from the record at the point it might be shared outside. And whether there is a security exception already in place to allow that or not. If there isn't, then should we add one? And if there is, then we're good to go.
Yeah, it's, you know, I can't really give you an answer, but I think it's a good point for the group to talk about whether those types of scenarios
okay.
would be covered by our current exceptions.
So, Arian, Anil, am I making sense, or is that stretching it too far?
I would tend to believe that this would be prohibited by law.
Yeah, I'm with
you. I agree with you, which goes back to my question of saying, is it prohibited by law or not?
If it's classified data, then sharing is prohibited by law. I think. Hey, I've got a fun one that is a real one that I just came across in my inbox.
Go ahead. I like the implication. Go ahead.
So this is not a national security exception, but so my understanding of the way that information blocking works is that it's permissible to not share if the patient has expressed preferences for data not to be shared, even though it may be allowed under HIPAA. And I forget which exception that is. That might be exception number one or two, 201 or 202.
202, it's under privacy.
202, all right. And I'm dealing with an organization whose organizational policies require opt-in affirmation. So I would believe that unless the state law requires affirmation in order for data to share, that in an information blocking context, information should share unless the patient has actually expressed a desire for information not to share.
I'm sorry.
Does it all make sense?
One more time.
Yeah, there's a couple of. Welcome to the double negatives. Okay. So, under under 202, there is an exception for where the patient has, what is the actual language? Anyway, so under 202, there is an exception where the patient has expressed a preference for data not to share. There is a very famous and rather annoying opt-in, opt-out distinction, where some organizations or entities require affirmative consent to share information. That is, they presume that the patient has affirmed a desire not to share unless they have actually affirmed a desire to share. My reading of information blocking, of the information blocking rules as currently described, is that unless there was a state and particular state law that said otherwise, the patient would have to affirm a desire not to share.
So,
Arian, this is...
Yeah, go ahead, Neil.
I was going to say, I thought 202 had organizational policy as well in there. And maybe I'm not absolutely understanding everything you're saying, but...
The forms the organizational policies and procedures that are in writing.
And if the organizational policy is based on state law for that state, which it probably has to be, at least the basis of it, then wouldn't by nature 202 cover...
No, I'm agreeing that if they're complying with state law, they're okay. But if they define an organizational policy that requires an affirmation of a desire to share before any data is shared, is that permissible or not permissible? If the state law
goes over and above what state law requires.
It goes over and above what state law requires and what HIPAA requires.
Yep.
Yeah, so, I mean, based on how 202 reads, I think that's what you're saying, Arian, is that that is a conflict between that and other parts of the rules that you've read, that the organizational policy versus the state
we've got an organization that covers multiple...
Yeah. So if the precondition requires on the provision of consent or authorization from an individual, the actor, subpart I, did all things reasonably necessary with this control to provide the individual with a meaningful opportunity to provide the consent or authorization, did not improperly encourage or induce the individual to not provide the consent or authorization. So there is a two-part test with respect to provision of consent or authorization.
And just a note for clarity, there is also the sub-exception for respecting an individual's request not to share information, which you're not talking... You're talking about the precondition not satisfied. Is that right?
Yeah,
that's where we are. That's exception B, yeah.
Okay.
So, Arian, when you were talking about state being over and above that, the requirements of the state, you know, this actually happens reasonably often where you've got an organization that spans multiple states and they have an organizational policy which is consistent with the most restrictive state.
Yep. Or they've got an organizational policy based on a risk determination that says they've got to have a patient affirmatively consent, but they don't provide... It's not easy. They don't provide notice. Patients don't know that they need to do that.
Actually, what happens in some cases is the policy is you get patient consent every single time you wish to share.
There's that
Arian, what's your... I understand that issue. What would the recommendation be to create another exception? Or I'm not sure.
Well, I'm just trying... First of all, just trying to understand...
Right.
What the actual language is?
It sounds like to me there may be another issue, which is that organizational policies may need to be revisited in order to make sure there's no unintended consequences against the information blocking provisions. And that in addition to reviewing all the contracts, the organizational policies may also need a two-year window to be revised or whatever, some language like that.
Okay, so this particular exception, which is 171202, is one that we've reviewed, but we have very little to say about it. We just talked about being documented and recorded, and the concept of meaningfulness. We asked whether that was expressed in HIPAA, and that was it. Arian, you talked about organizational practices in extra to HIPAA, kind of where you're thinking about right now.
Yeah, that's right.
You actually make the statement here, organizational practices extra to HIPAA or other legislation should be clearly forbidden. Now, I'm not quite sure that's the tenant, this is particularly the context you meant it, but...
I think that's the maximum stance. I think it's a reasonable stance to ask for. I believe in practice that organizational policy is used as an excuse not to share by many actors.
So let's say you have an organization that has a provider site in Delaware and one in Pennsylvania. All right.
Welcome to my world.
So tell me what's going to happen here. Are we permitting the organization to have a single policy that covers both of them, or are we saying actually you need to have a different policy depending on the state?
Well, so I direct you to page 406 where we talk about when there's conflicting state privacy laws, and it'd probably be easiest just to read that. In fairness, it doesn't necessarily get at the organizational policy issue you're talking about, but it does talk about when
the directive of the page may or may not answer that question.
I think your question was about conflicting state laws. If one state has more restrictive privacy laws than others, then another one does, and you do business in both states.
Because you're in accommodation, sub-accession, recognized access of the legal profession.
So if an actor is required by law to obtain an individual's HIPAA authorization before providing access, then the individual's refusal to provide an authorization would justify the actor's refusal to provide access.
Where are you reading, Ryan?
This is 405.
Okay. Sorry, I was on 406.
But if the actor is not required by law to obtain prior authorization,
so, Arian, go to the top of 406, where actually the preamble specifically talks about actors that operate across state lines. With organization-wide privacy practices that conform with the most restrictive... It's almost like we wrote this, Arian. In order to accommodate subsection of the reference status of service for you. I get what you're saying here. We're considering a sub-exception that recognizes an actor's observance of a legal precondition that they're required to satisfy at least one state in which it operates.
I would say that as a platform that has done the hard work of trying to make this configurable based on the differing of state law, I'd say... If the result of this is to flow all restrictions down to the point of the most restrictive state, then I think that would tend to be a not good idea.
I kind of, just from a general patient benefit point of view, because we are, if I look at the market in general, we are seeing an increase in consolidation and cross-state boundary healthcare systems will become more the norm than they are right now. There are notable ones right now. It seems that, you know, you could end up with a position eventually where the majority of the organizations you might seek to care from would actually be multi-state. And therefore, it doesn't really matter what state you're receiving care in. It's always going to float up to the level of the most restrictive. I can't see why that would be good for patient care. Just for the, I'm trying not to overly trivialise here, but just for the sake of having the hard work with Xiaomi and you've built already, to be configured appropriately in technology. And technology is supposed to cope with this difference in context.
Yep.
No, this is Mark. Thanks for directing us to this. You're obviously seeking comment on this. Oh, we seek comment on whether there is a need. Yeah, we'll give you comment.
Well, great. Yeah, and I think the the tie-in with the conversation about organizational policies, it fits as well for your comments if you wanted to make them.
Yeah, I think organizational policy consideration is good, but I think I almost minded, are we as a group, and obviously this will go to wider task force for consideration, but are we as a group actually generally saying, not only do we suggest that this isn't made an exception, that we explicitly say this should not happen.
I believe so.
I think so, Andy. I mean, that's it's recommendations, right? In terms of how we should be approaching this. So yes.
I'm just noting this into the document.
Hey guys, I've got to roll off the call. I'm really sorry.
That's right, no worries. We've got 50 minutes left.
Okay.
Thanks
okay.
for joining.
Hold on. Now I'm getting better. All right. So the actual language in 202 is conditioned on if an actor is required by a state or federal privacy law to satisfy a condition prior to providing access, the actor may choose not to provide access if the condition has not been satisfied, provided that the practice conforms to the scope to actor's organizational policies, and da 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 da. If the organizational policy requires relies on the provision of consent or authorization, then there's also a two-part test of did all things reasonably necessary and did not improperly encourage or induce.
Yep.
So the way I read 202 is as I stated, which is that requiring affirmative consent prior to sharing is allowed only if required by a state or federal privacy law, and then only in cases where there is where there's all things reasonably necessary and no attempt to induce.
So I think that's what we were just talking about.
Yep, that's right. I think 202 states where the position that we think is appropriate, and I think we want to, with respect to that comment or request for comment, I think we want to state that we actually think 202 is fine as is.
It's fine as is, but with consideration to be more explicit around organizational policies needing to conform to the states in which that consent is being sought, as opposed to floating up to the most restrictive.
That's right.
Yeah. Okay. So that was a good conversation, that one. What about health providers that are not regulated by the HIPAA privacy rule?
Well, there's a sub exception for that as well.
It feels like that they're exactly the same. Well, you're governed by your state rules, and you shouldn't. Let's say I'm a. I'm trying to think of an example that would be multi-state that wouldn't be governed by HIPAA. I think there are a couple. You're governed by the state laws. You shouldn't be putting in place an organisational policy which is conformant with the. Yeah, the most restrictive. Got it. Okay. We should say the same thing. Okay.
That was good. I'm actually going to suggest, given it's 3:18, should we go to public comment?
Why not? Let's do it. Operator, can you open the public line?
If you would like to make a public comment, please press star 1 on your telephone keypad. A confirmation tone will indicate your line is in the queue. You may press star 2 if you would like to remove your comment from the queue. For participants using speaker equipment, it may be necessary to pick up your handset before pressing the star keys.
Thank you very much. If you're in the public gallery on this, we really would like to have your comments. Operator, is there anybody entering the queue?
There are no comments at this time.
Ugh. I'm disappointed. Okay.
Sorry.
Arian, where do you want to go
there
in the line?
There have to be some people who have been hanging on to our every word and are just, for whatever reason, don't want to get into the act. But I just encourage all the thousands and thousands of people who are listening to these calls to pick up the phone and make a comment, because we really want to hear from you.
I mean, your cynicism is palpable, borderline. But actually, there are actually public comments, public observers. So it'd be good to, on all the calls now, we're noticing them more and more. So it's really good to get public feedback to at least tell us whether we're on the straight and narrow or whether we need to go in another direction, or, that'd be good to receive.
Yeah,
okay.
So what's the process? Maybe, Andy, we could talk about what's the process to getting. We've got a lot of comments now in the spreadsheet. We've had a number of discussion points that are captured through all the transcripts. In my past work as a task force chair, I have personally taken on the labor and effort of writing up the recommendations so that they're just so, and then going through a review process with the task force members. I think we're supposed to deliver recommendations for next meeting, which is in 3 weeks from now, 2.5 weeks from now. Is that right?
Yep. So I gently chide you and tell you what I think the process should be?
Yes, please.
And that was meant with all the love in the world. And that's on the public record now. The intended proposal, look, just so you know, work group one, we've already got a first cut of drafting, and we're working through that and finessing as we go. Work group three is pretty much in the same state. This work group, we haven't. So my proposal was going to be that actually we divide and conquer on the drafting. I'm not sure, actually, I think back to the policy committee, there was stuff back there that was like this, but there's a lot of thinking in here. I think it's going to take quite a lot of time to actually come up with even just the first cut of our proposed regulation. I'm proposing that we divide and conquer amongst the group, and Arian and Val left at completely the wrong times for us to point them at some of this stuff. But we're going to have to, I think. And the approach we've taken elsewhere, for rightly or wrongly, and this is in conversation with ONC and trying to make their jobs a bit easier going forward, is we've created our recommendations in each area under three headings: discussion, recommended regulatory text, and recommended preamble. The discussion is to capture the various different flavors and sentiments that we have discussed, and the various different opinions and views which have been discussed into a short narrative fully understands the context and where we're coming from on the recommendations. The second part around the regulatory text is a complete rendition of the appropriate regulatory text with all our proposed amendments, probably the wrong flavor, recommendations to changes inside it. And then the third, with the preamble, is either replace the preamble with this, or, as is more often the case, we suggest that you put these paragraphs into the preamble as well. That's kind of the approach that we've taken. It's been pretty, it's worked pretty well in Work Group 1 and 3. I appreciate this Work Group 2 is a bit different. What it does give us is the ability in our recommendation to say, we suggest you change the entire regulatory X or big, these big chunks of it, etc. And it makes it easier for ONC to say, okay, this is what they want us to, or their recommendations to do with this exception. Does that make, is that clear?
Yeah. Do we have proposed definitions? So as I think you've been following my logic, I believe that the particularly the fee structure information blocking exception, there's a dependency between the definition of EHI, the definition of information blocking, the definition of health information network and health IT and developer of certified health IT technology. And I wonder how we reconcile that plus the actual information blocking reg text. Because I could go, as you well know, I could go down a rabbit hole of tailoring all the definitional work to land out in the right point with the information blocking exceptions. But if we've already done that definitional work, then there's just a dependency back and forth.
Yeah, so up until about 36 hours ago, I would have said, well, just go and look at the Work Group 1 document, and you've got it all in there, and it's pretty well laid out. Today morning's Work Group 1 call, there was a great deal of discussion around the scope, some of which was in alignment with your thinking. Some of it was clearly definitely not. This is a beast we're going to have to wrestle forward with, the fact that these things are going to line in and line out as we go. My suggestion is go and look at what the current definitions are and use those, whether or not you agree with them, use them, but make comments the delta in your agreement, and we will go back and take that on board in that work group. However, very, very short term, we're going to be moving into the full task force and considering all these together so we actually get that relationship between them. And you're right, there is a bi-directional dependency between them.
Okay.
If it helps, you could self-elect to take on specific exceptions to start drafting on that would not feel yourself compromised.
I'm down with going for fees.
That's good.
If that's what you're asking.
Yeah. As a matter of principle, I think we're kind of suggesting from your point earlier, we should collapse fees into a single one.
Yep.
Okay. And I think
so pursuant to our comments, we should collapse fees to a single one. We should make a distinction between where fees are problematic and tailor the fee. This is where the definition of information blocking and the fee language are dependent. I don't know how to untie the knot, because I think we want to say some fees do not constitute information blocking and some fees could constitute information blocking, and here's the appropriate framework for those fees, right?
You know, Arian, I'm just going to pick you up on a point that you made earlier, which I think I agree with. And you made the point earlier that maybe we should be looking at fees in more of a permissive tone than an exception tone. I'm paraphrasing.
Yep. Exactly.
And if we do that, then I've got no problems with the recommendation of the group being these two exceptions you've got, collapse them into one and take them out of exceptions and put it into a permissive section around fees that can be charged. And we can make that recommendation. Whether or not ONC can take it on is another matter. but that's for them to litigate on, and not for, it's our recommendation, and that can be our recommendation.
Yep, I'll take a crack at it.
Okay, on the workgroup 2 exceptions workbook, it will be the last box down the bottom.
Okay.
I did have a chat with people as well over the last few days around where we typically see the word royalty used, and I had a quick look at a bunch of contracts as well. We don't use it. We use the word charge.
That's a very different context.
Yeah. Well, no, even when if it's a charge for the use of intellectual property or a charge for a license to a component or a charge for access to a service or a charge, we just use charge. The exception is if we've used the term, well, we might use the term royalty, is where there's some kind of proportional payment that's due based upon revenues accrued. Is that helpful for you as you go through this?
Do you have comments in the document?
Yeah, there's comments in the document.
Okay.
But I was actually going to suggest, I'm happy to have like a bit of a mini work session, just two of us to go through this if you feel that's appropriate as well.
Let me just propose something and then you guys can tear it up. It's honestly, it's usually the easiest way to get this up is just for me to write something really terrible and then throw it out to the group and have it nitpicked to death, and then we get something better.
I'll take that as an appropriate not bad. That's fine, man. No problem at all. Okay. We're at the bottom of the hour. Have we got any calls coming through on the public line? I'll take that as a no.
Yes,
operator?
Operator, were there any comments in the queue?
There are no comments in the queue at this time.
Okay. Lauren, we can probably close down.
Alrighty. Thank you guys for another good call.
Thanks.
Okay,
all right,
bye-bye.
Thanks everyone.
Thanks guys, have a good day. Take care, bye-bye.